This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, fears more violence could follow in Sri Lanka. But how could these bombings, possibly planned by outsiders, exacerbate the island nation's religious and ethnic fault lines? Also, the water buyback controversy. The federal government orders a review as political pressure continues. And as the campaign rolls on, bookies are taking bets. But should betting on the federal election be legal?
There's a massive risk of corruption, and I think many of the successful bets on this election are insiders.
Let me tell you, every party thinks that they're going to win, or they've got their own internal polling, but they don't always win. And, you know, Donald Trump is one of those. Brexit was another.
Welcome to the program. A state of emergency has taken effect in Sri Lanka after the Easter Sunday bombings. The Defence Force has been given wide powers and dozens have been arrested after the six near simultaneous attacks on churches and hotels left more than 300 dead and scores more injured. Today was an official day of mourning in the country with funeral prayers held at Sri Lankan churches. But some despairing relatives are yet to even identify the bodies of their slain loved ones. Tanya Warnakulasuraya is a writer based in Colombo. She's been at St Anthony's, one of the churches that was targeted in the capital today, as well as to the police morgue, which is nearby. But I asked her first about the mood in the capital.
Well, Linda, the mood is still one of shock and devastation. There's a lot of just abject sorrow, people sort of eyes rolling upwards to the heavens in prayer, and not just Christians, but, you know, all the religions and the communities. For example, in the Kochikode area, where St. Anthony's Church is, a lot of pilgrims have come from all over the country. So Christians celebrating St. Anthony come to that church because it's a church that normally performs miracles. And at Easter time, they have the Mass, and so there were victims not just from Colombo, but from all over the country. And so there were bodies that sort of had to be identified and repatriated and buried back in as far as Jaffna and Manar, all across the country. And people from very poor backgrounds have come all that way. And some of them, you know, with great difficulty trying to take bodies back.
And you've, I understand, been to some of the mortuaries today. How are they coping?
Well, they're making the best of a bad situation, and I hope that doesn't sound glib. You know, people are coming. They've been asked to come to the police morgue. They come with a photograph, and then they're asked to look at a screen of deceased victims. And as you can imagine from a bomb blast, the pictures of those victims are, you know, are quite horrific. And trying to identify loved ones from sometimes just body parts, from belt buckles and jewellery that was worn, as you can imagine, would be incredibly horrific. So there's a sort of stunned silence when you walk in there, sort of a reverence, but a very eerie kind of shock as people are just watching these pictures and trying to identify loved ones. Very, very sad.
And what about the political fallout? Has the government offered any further explanation about the claim that intelligence pointing to likely Easter attacks was not acted on?
Well, it's a sort of a passive-aggressive approach. You have the government apologising for not acting fast enough and for having information, but that information was not acted upon. So there is an apology. And then beyond that apology, you have sort of the laying of blame at various departments as to why this information was not acted upon. They do say, the ministries do say that there had to be, because it was such a strategic attack, that they do think there's sort of external international involvement and that everybody's doing as much as they can. I know the head of the army is looking to take on police powers, so that because we're currently in a declared state of emergency, he's seeking arresting powers to the army. So people are trying to do the best they can within the ministries, but there is this sort of initial apology and then sort of blame as to the reasons why.
Tanya Warnakulasuraya is a writer based in Colombo. Well, observers are cautioning that the Easter Sunday attacks should not necessarily be seen simply as Muslims versus Christians, amid indications that a small, little-known Muslim group with international help carried out the attacks. Sri Lanka has a complex ethnic and religious makeup and a long history of violence as minorities have tried to find their place under majority Sinhalese rule. Mario Arulthas is the advocacy director for the Washington DC-based People for Equality and Relief in Lanka, a Tamil advocacy group, and he's a human rights fellow at the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership. He says even after the end of the long war against the Tamils 10 years ago next month, tensions and violence have been a constant backdrop.
It's not a straightforward Christian versus Muslim as what you see in many other countries, but actually Muslims have been targeted by the Sinhala Buddhist majority for the last 10 years. And meanwhile, Christian minority groups, especially those of Protestant denominations, evangelical denominations, were attacked. And actually, if you look at reports released last year, including by the US government, 2018 saw a sharp increase in attacks on Christian churches by Sinhala Buddhist groups. The last attack was actually just a week ago at a church in central Sri Lanka where a mass marking Palm Sunday was attacked by Buddhist groups.
So this is well outside of past patterns, isn't it? I mean, can we locate it in the history?
No, we cannot. The history of violence against Christians, the history of violence against Muslims and against Tamils does not fit in with these attacks. This is a completely new front, so to say, of attacks that we've seen. However, the risk of these attacks is that they exacerbate the existing tensions. That this was probably one of the intentions of the attackers, that this will increase the existing divide between these, the very complex relationship between these groups.
And so we've also seen officials naming a hitherto little-known Islamist organisation of domestic origins in Sri Lanka as being part of this. Again, we're not clear. But what do you make of that, the naming of that group? And what are there risks involved in coming out with the name of a particular organisation at this point?
This particular organization is actually not very well known. As you said, it's a very small group. However, the local community where this group is based has protested against this group as long as 2 years ago. In 2017, the Muslim community sat on the street with placards calling on the government to arrest these people because they were influencing the children in a bad way. And they were calling them terrorists and they were calling them jihadis. However, that did not gain much traction in Sri Lanka. It wasn't covered widely in the press in Sri Lanka. And I think the authorities just didn't take this very seriously. But what you can see now is that suddenly the Muslim community is blamed for not having said anything before, where in fact they have. Even 3 years ago when these concerns were raised, where people said, hey, there's a risk of radicalization amongst the Muslim population, it was often dismissed by people who thought this was born out of Islamophobic tropes or, you know, community issues rather than something that's actually a substantial threat. So it's interesting to see that the government has ignored those concerns by the community itself in the past, but also the recent intelligence that suggested an attack was planned. And this seems to be a complete failure of the government to act on intelligence they've received.
So what should the Sri Lankan government do now if it's to keep the threads of Sri Lankan society together?
I think there's a larger issue in Sri Lanka where many of its citizens do not feel part of the state because the Sinhala Buddhist nationalist identity of what it means to be Sri Lankan has just not gelled well with especially the Tamil community. And since the 1970s, there's been a propensity for separatism that the Tamil people wanted to separate from the state. In the Muslim community, of course, it wasn't as pronounced. However, if you look at some of the propaganda that these groups that are now reported to be the attackers, what they have put out is, it is actually against the Sinhala Buddhist nature of the state, then they're using that to radicalize the population too. So I think Sri Lanka itself needs a reckoning about how it sees itself and the identity of the country itself and whether it really wants to be a singular Buddhist majoritarian state or truly pluralistic country.
Mario Arulthas from People for Equality and Relief in Lanka, and he's a human rights fellow at the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership as well. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram, and I'm on Twitter at Linda Mottram. Ahead, the US attempts to wipe out Iran's oil exports, and some analysts expect that that means petrol prices could be heading much higher. Well, the Easter lull barely lasted the distance for the campaigning Prime Minister and opposition leader because water buybacks overtook any piety, and now both sides have been forced onto the defensive over a water buyback deal done 2 years ago. There has been a growing clamour for former Water Minister Barnaby Joyce to explain how the Commonwealth buying water rights from Queensland farms led to $80 million of taxpayers' money going to a Cayman Islands tax haven-based company that used to be connected to a government minister. Our political reporter, Melissa Clark, is in Canberra and joins me. Melissa, it's the way with campaigns, isn't it? The leaders set out to campaign on their chosen issues and some other annoyance just won't die. Water buybacks in this case.
And it's certainly not dying off yet. Look, Scott Morrison spent the day in Adelaide, specifically in the marginal seat of Boothby, which the Liberals are hoping to hold on to. And he really wanted to talk about small businesses and assistance that their policies will offer to small businesses. Likewise, the opposition leader Bill Shorten was in far north Queensland, in Gladstone and Mackay, in seats of Flynn and Dawson that they're hoping to take off the government, wanting to talk wages and migration. But it's the details of this water buyback from 2 years ago that was the topic du jour in federal politics that both leaders were having to talk about. And while there's no evidence rules were broken, some of the details are prompting demands for more transparency. Let's start with the basics. In 2017, the Commonwealth purchased water entitlements from two properties near St George in Queensland, in the northern part of the Murray-Darling Basin. It spent $80 million to purchase 28 gigalitres of overland flow, water that runs onto farms when the river floods and breaks its banks. It was a big windfall for the company that owned the two farms, Eastern Agriculture Australia. And given one of EAA's early directors was Angus Taylor, now the Energy Minister, the opposition is among those asking whether the Commonwealth paid too much. Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen.
This is a serious matter. I mean, we're talking about $80 million worth of taxpayers' funds here, which appears to have been spent on basically nothing. I mean, basically air, not water.
The water purchase was part of a broader plan to reduce over-allocation of water to irrigators and see more water return to the river. Sometimes this is done through a tender process, but with concerns about regional towns being decimated if too many farms in one area sold their water, the Commonwealth also negotiates directly with water holders to find the best outcome both financially and for regional communities. Barnaby Joyce was the water minister who signed off on the $80 million purchase from EAA, which was a direct negotiation, and says the deal was all above board.
This was a recommendation that goes right back to 2015 for what we purchased from a Queensland Labor minister. A Queensland Labor minister made the recommendation to us.
The Queensland Natural Resources Minister then and now is Anthony Lynham.
Due diligence, price, governance are all Barnaby Joyce's responsibilities. The Queensland government role is straightforward. It's administrative.
Dr. Lynham says his government had thought it was a good deal to buy water from EAA 2 years earlier.
Now, what we supported in 2015 was completely different.
He says that Barnaby Joyce's predecessor had suggested buying the two properties, the land, water from the river and the overland flows, at a better price. But when Barnaby Joyce took over as water minister, that was abandoned.
Now, I feel we missed a big opportunity back in 2015. Back in 2015, it was definitely a buyer's market. It was up to the federal government to pursue these negotiations.
Donna Stewart is the former mayor of the Boulogne-Condamine Shire, where the EAA properties are. At the time, she was also a member of the advisory committee to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority and closely involved in the process. She's confirmed to the Country Hour in Queensland that Barnaby Joyce wasn't keen on buying the water in 2015.
Well, Barnaby was opposed to it because I think he realised that, you know, buying such a large volume of water right on the doorstep of St George was going to have a very severe impact on the town.
But 2 years later, Queensland was behind in the amount of water it was supposed to have returned to the river. And Donna Stewart says that left the Commonwealth with very few options.
There was really nowhere else that they would have got that volume of water.
Instead of buying the properties, river water and overland water flows for $123 million, the Commonwealth bought just the rights to the overland flow for $80 million.
People were quite amazed at the price, but you know, when it's the only way left of meeting those targets of the plan for, you know, our section of the river in Queensland here, it's pretty obvious that you're going to have to, you know, pay money.
Barnaby Joyce says those details were for the department to work out.
The minister, myself, at that time was not involved in negotiations of price or of vendor. That is done by the department at arm's length to me.
Labor is demanding more information about the process and fending off accusations it too overspent on buying back water in other transactions. It's still not clear who ultimately is the beneficiary of the $80 million purchase. That's thanks to the opacity of the Cayman Islands registered company, Eastern Agriculture Australia. The Auditor General will investigate this purchase and others, but that won't inform voters in time for next month's election.
Melissa Clark with that report. Well, I wonder if you've ever been tempted to bet on the federal election. The odds are sometimes cited in media coverage, but critics say that gambling is becoming too embedded in the electoral process and is influencing how we view elections. There are some calls now for political insiders to be banned from betting on politics, while experts worry that elections are being used to sign up new betting customers. Eliza Borello reports.
Go to most betting agencies' websites at the moment and you'll find a variety of election-related categories to bet on. There's the actual Liberal v Labor result, how many seats a particular party might win by, and which candidate will win in key seats. Jared Daffy is the Senior Communications Advisor at the betting agency TAB. He estimates more than $10 million was bet in Australia on the 2016 election and says this election's figures are already looking healthy for TAB.
It would be in excess of what, say, an AFL or an NRL grand final or a State of Origin would be, and probably in the ballpark of what a Melbourne Cup would be fixed odds.
Tasmanian Independent MP Andrew Wilkie doesn't like the attention election betting is getting.
Over the last handful of elections, clearly gambling on the election, on the results of the election, has been getting more commentary, it's had a higher profile.
Stephen Koukoulis is the Managing Director of Market Economics and advised former Labor Prime Minister Julia Gillard.
It is interesting when we do know that there's a major poll about to be released that the betting markets tend to have a pickup in turnover, and when we see the polling results actually published, it's interesting that the markets have tended to anticipate what that move is. And of course, when the move is publicly available, then the markets, of course, react to that as well.
And what does that suggest to you is happening?
It suggests to me that perhaps someone in the know, with a little bit of preemptive knowledge of what the poll might be showing, take advantage of that knowledge and put a bet on one side or other, whichever one's obviously got the benefit of the polling results that are about to be released.
Anecdotes like this worry Andrew Wilkie.
Anyone involved in the political process in any way should be banned from involving themselves in betting on elections.
Stephen Mayne, a spokesman for the Alliance for Gambling Reform, has similar concerns.
There's a massive risk of corruption, and I think many of the successful bets on this election are insiders who are profiting and trading from their inside knowledge.
But Jared Daffy from TAB disagrees.
There is always a mention of insider trading, but let me tell you, every party thinks that they're going to win or they've got their own internal polling, but they don't always win. And, you know, Donald Trump is one of those. Brexit was another.
Sally Gainsbury is an associate professor in the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney's School of Psychology. She says betting on elections raises integrity questions.
So with most sporting organisations, there's a sporting body to ensure that all events are conducted with integrity, and there are bans on people with potential inside knowledge, like match officials or players actually placing bets. One of the concerns with election betting is there's no identification or prohibition on people who might have insider knowledge to stop them from actually betting.
Overall, Sally Gainsbury believes betting agencies are using the election as a marketing tool.
Signing people up for something like an election bet can be a way for a wagering company to try and entice them to gamble on sports and horse racing events in the future.
Professor Sally Gainsbury from the University of Sydney. Eliza Borello, our reporter. Well, Queensland tourism operators and scientists are warning the major parties not to ignore the health of the Great Barrier Reef if they want to hold on to or win marginal seats federally. The World Heritage Area is the world's largest reef system. It also generates $6 billion and supports 63,000 jobs every year. Tourism business owners say climate change is the biggest risk to the marine ecosystem and their livelihoods, and they've been voicing demands to step up the move away from fossil fuels. Stephanie Smale reports.
About 30,000 tourists a year take day trips to the Great Barrier Reef on Alan Wallace's boats, but the Cairns-based operator doesn't feel like the region is a priority for federal politicians.
We compete on the world stage for tourism. We have to have the best practices, we have to have the best boats, and that produces a lot of money for the Australian economy, and it should really be taken seriously.
Alan Wallace has seen a lot of time and money spent on improving water quality, removing crown of thorns starfish, and reducing toxic runoff from coastal agriculture. But he points out climate change is his main worry when it comes to the future of the reef.
You know, has the federal government done enough in the past? They've done a lot, but they could do better. And whoever comes in, they have to do better.
The Great Barrier Reef stretches from central Queensland to Cape York, with much of the World Heritage Area sitting in waters off the federal electorate of Leichhardt. The Liberal National Party's Warren Entsch holds the seat by a margin of 3.9%. Alan Wallace acknowledges the federal government has committed almost $500 million to the Great Barrier Reef Foundation for reef conservation, but he points out there's no clear indication where that money will go.
I'd like to think that whoever takes control of government will ensure that that money comes back into our industry in some way or another.
Some tourism operators further south also name climate change as their top concern. Tony Fontes is a dive instructor in North Queensland's Whitsunday Islands. He says the LNP's George Christensen, who holds the seat of Dawson by a margin of 3.4%, needs to listen to his coastal constituents, not just those back in coal mining.
This particular election, he needs to recognise that climate change is the number one issue, get on board with the rest of his constituents, particularly in tourism.
He says the federal government's $500 million commitment to the reef is the best thing they've done, but he's frustrated that some of his fellow tourism operators are torn between perceived perks for small business and protecting the environment.
Their entire livelihood is based on the health of the reef, but then they're concerned about small business concerns and what policy each of the major parties offers them to keep them operating.
The Cairns Chamber of Commerce, that represents small businesses in and around the city, thinks the federal government should be doing more to protect the reef. But President Nick Lucas argues policy doesn't have to be a choice between supporting business and conservation.
There is absolutely nothing that says you can't do a better job of looking after the environment and support business, and especially small business.
He points out the local business community likes the idea of moving away from fossil fuels, but they're worried high power prices will get worse if it's not managed properly.
We want the best thing for the environment, but we also want to make sure that the businesses can afford it. So where the government needs to put their effort is, okay, we want to pick up renewable, we want to do better, we want to get rid of fossil fuels, but what are you doing to help the businesses transition?
World-leading reef scientist Ove Hegeldberg witnessed the mass coral bleaching that hit the Great Barrier Reef 2 years ago firsthand.
The problems haven't gone away. When you dive up in the northern and central sectors of the Great Barrier Reef, you see more dead coral than live coral.
In the climate change debate, he says he doesn't usually pick sides, but he says Labor's policy is everything he's hoped for, including a net zero emissions target by 2050.
It's the narratives like the Great Barrier Reef that should have the politicians changing tack. What we've been doing so far hasn't worked quite clearly. We need to go to almost an emergency plan to prevent this ecosystem from disappearing.
He's also frustrated some voters in the marginal seats neighbouring the Great Barrier Reef are torn between coal mining jobs and protecting the environment.
When there's a system that earns, you know, $6 billion each year for the Australian economy, employs, you know, 63,000 people in a largely sustainable context, we've really got to look at that versus the short-term gains and the spin that is being trotted out.
A Labor spokeswoman told PM the party will be making Great Barrier Reef announcements later in the campaign, but it will stand by its pledge to end the Great Barrier Reef Foundation contract. The federal government was asked to outline its previous work and future policies for the reef, but PM didn't receive a response.
Stephanie Smale with that report. In a move designed to cripple Iran's economy and curtail its nuclear arsenal, the United States has given countries who are still buying Iranian oil 1 week to stop or face heavy economic sanctions. Roughly a year ago, President Trump imposed economic sanctions on Iran and instructed other countries to stop buying its oil, though some had a waiver to continue purchases for a while. But as that comes to an end, the other casualty might be consumers, because global oil markets could be rocked, threatening even higher petrol prices. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
The cost of living continues to rise, and the price of petrol has become one of the main offenders.
What we have seen with the recent lift in prices is that monthly household spend jumped to about $240.
ComSec economist Ryan Felsman tracks the oil market and its flow-on effects to the petrol bowser and your hip pocket. He says the oil price is currently nudging a six-month high and could easily climb higher, producing more pain for motorists at the pump.
Yes, we could see a sizable increase, really.
Petrol prices are higher because of threats to global oil supply. Fears of further supply threats were heightened last night when the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo warned China and India, if they continue to buy oil from Iran, they'd suffer harsh economic penalties. The move completes the sanctions program that President Trump reimposed nearly a year ago when he withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. Brian Hook is US Special Envoy to Iran.
And Iran has a choice. They can either start behaving like a normal nation or they can watch their economy crumble.
He spoke to financial news service Bloomberg to explain the move.
We've already seen an impact. Iran is having a harder time meeting their funding commitments for Hezbollah, for Hamas, for their Shia proxies in Syria. And so we want to make it hard for Iran to execute its foreign policy. We're going to continue putting pressure on this regime.
Before the reimposition of sanctions last year, Iran was the fourth largest producer among OPEC countries, pumping out roughly 3 million barrels per day. Last month, exports shrunk to below 1 million barrels per day. Brian Hook dismisses fears of massive disruptions to the market, despite the price of crude lifting 3% on rumours of the sanctions.
Iranian crude is not an exotic crude, and there's a number of countries that can supply China with its energy needs. There will not be any supply interruption as a consequence of our decision today.
Sydney-based Henry Jennings is a day trader, closely watching financial markets. He says it's impossible to know how supply will ultimately be affected by this latest move from the Trump administration, but the timing of the announcement's designed to cause the least impact on the price of oil.
It is an interesting timing, I guess, but maybe he was hoping it would sort of get lost in the Easter lull.
He sees global oil supply falling further from here and prices lifting.
At the moment, sentiment is running, the oil is heading higher. It doesn't take much for that to continue, and certainly putting taking out that supply of Iranian oil to those sanctioned countries is not going to hold the oil price back. In fact, it's done quite the opposite and pushed it up 3%. So that's what markets move on, and there is a fear that supply is going to dry up.
It's not just motorists feeling the pinch. Tens of thousands of Australian businesses rely heavily on diesel, which could also now rise. Sunira Tenakoon is an oil and gas industry analyst with AME Group.
So if the diesel price goes up, and it was a bit higher in the last few months, this actually increases the operation expenses of most of the manufacturing companies in Australia.
Are you expecting the price of diesel to keep rising?
Yes.
The hope for motorists and businesses across the country is that countries like Saudi Arabia will make up the supply difference. Comsec's Ryan Felsman.
We're likely to see US oil production lift, and of course Saudi Arabia is keen to increase supply to offset those losses of Iranian crude exports.
But in Asian trade today, the price of oil continued to climb. Global investment bank Barclays adding that the US announcement took many by surprise and that the move would, quote, significantly tighten oil markets.
David Taylor with that report. And that is PM for today. I'm Linda Mottram. You can find us on the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts as well. And do subscribe while you're there and leave a review. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hello there, PK and Fran here from the Party Room.
Are you a little confused about this water buyback story? Let's face it, who isn't?
If you want the inside scoop on that interview with Barnaby Joyce, if you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive and we are broadcasting across the Asia Pacific. Barnaby Joyce is our guest.
The Labor Party were the first people.
If you haven't heard it, you better. We've made a bonus episode of The Party Room for you. It's in your feed now.
Search for The Party Room wherever you get your podcasts or find us on the ABC Listen app.